We wanna smash, crash, bash, smash, blast the system. We wanna get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, fist pumping, rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want, we want, we want, we want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we welcome back Professor Peter Kuznick from American University. He's co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. Peter Kuznick is also part of a new working group compiling a transnational COVID-19 solidarity manifesto about how the current crisis is giving us an opportunity to rethink the failures of neoliberalism and decide the kind of world we want. Today on the Project Censored Show for the hour, we welcome the perspectives of historian Peter Kuznick. Stay with us.
Political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, skies, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we are delighted to welcome back historian Professor Peter Kuznick. He is co-author with Oliver Stone of the award-winning and best-selling book, The Untold History of the United States, along with the accompanying 12-part series that can be viewed online, which is now also on Netflix. This is a riveting history, mostly of 20th century into 21st century America. Peter Kuznick has been on the program several times before to talk about not just the past, but how it impacts the present, and today is no different. On today's show, we welcome Peter Kuznick back to the program. Again, he is professor of history and director of the award-winning Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. He's written extensively about science, politics, nuclear history, and Cold War culture. And Peter Kuznick is now part of a very recently developed movement of sorts, Transnational COVID-19 Social Solidarity Movement. And there is a manifesto in the works. And this is all very recent, and we'll have more details for you. But basically, it starts like this. The COVID-19 crisis has revealed the urgency of changing global structures of inequity and violence. We, people around the world, will seize this historical moment. We are building solidarity at every level, local, national, global. Despite the need to physically distance, we are building mutual aid groups, community networks, and social movements. We declare this manifesto today to offer a vision of the world we are building, the world we are demanding, the world we will achieve. And that is a fantastic and ambitious opening statement to this new document that we'll link to. But Peter Kuznick, we're going to talk about what's going on around the world through the lens of COVID-19 and also get more historical perspective. Peter, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks, Mickey. It's always fun to be on your show.
And it's always a delight to have you. You always have so much to say and shed so much light and share insight with us. Let's start. We're in unprecedented times with this global pandemic and this shutdown of sorts with the sheltering in place. This is something that's happening in a lot of parts of the world. There's also a lot of contention around the way things have been happening around it.
One of the sad things about what we're going through now is that we're in very precedented times. It's unprecedented in our lifetimes, but in a historical sense, we've been through this so many times, we should have been prepared for this. We can talk later about the great plagues in history, the bubonic plague of the 14th century, the Black Death that killed one-third of the world's population. We can talk about the plagues brought by Columbus and the Spanish conquistadores, who brought diseases that the Native Americans had no immunities to. And actually, according to some estimates, probably killed off 90% of the Caribbean population. We can talk about the 1918 flu epidemic, or even if we look much more recently, since the 21st century, we've got the SARS pandemic in 2002, 2003, the H1N1 swine flu in 2009, the MERS pandemic in 2012, Ebola 2014 to 16. You know, the crime in all of this is that it is so precedented. We should have been prepared. And to see all the death and suffering and dislocation now is just really a reflection of the fact that we don't have, not only in the United States, where we've got a clown for the president, but in other parts of the world also. We just are not prepared as a species, as a planet, to deal with the real problems. We waste vast amounts of money building up our militaries and our intelligence apparatuses, but we don't spend anything close to the kind of money that's needed for healthcare, for education, for water, for food, for defending the environment.
When I was talking about how it's unprecedented, it's from a very specific lens from where we are right now in the U.S. in the 21st century in terms of what we're experiencing. But the flip side of that, you just answered, this actually isn't unprecedented in a lot of ways. So you read my mind.
Well, you're an historian. You've got a similar perspective and put this in the context the way I do. And the group that we're organizing, which now consists of scholars and activists in maybe a dozen countries, is mostly trying to frame the discussion. Because on the one hand, this is a great tragedy. On the other hand, it's a great opportunity. Because times like this, some people driven by fear or by greed have their own agendas. And sometimes it brings out the worst in people, the ugliest sides of human nature. But on the other hand, we have an opportunity to begin thinking differently about what's happening in the world now and to be looking for deeper kinds of solutions, because what we're trying to do with this manifesto is help people frame the issues in ways that they don't always think about it, to get at what's the real underlying causes for what we're facing now on a global scale. And one of the lessons of the past is that what we've seen so far might just be the tip of the iceberg. One of the reasons why I've studied the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic is because the first wave, and we know the history of this, the first wave starts in March of 1918 in the United States at Camp Funston in Fort Riley, Kansas. And the first wave is actually quite mild. The deaths don't occur on a tremendous scale in the United States till September of 1918, when there's a second wave of the disease. And in October of 1918 alone, 195,000 Americans died in that month alone. And then the third wave is also much worse than the first wave. And the third wave doesn't start till January of 1919 and goes on till the summer. So when people look back at the history of these things, they should be much more concerned than a lot of people are. In the last couple of days, I've heard people start to talk about the likelihood of a second wave. And while Trump wants to deny it, of course, his scientists and doctors are saying, yes, of course, we've got to prepare for a second wave. And to even call it the Spanish flu, you know why that was the case, but most people probably don't. This was taking place during World War I. Spain was a neutral country in World War I. So whereas most of the combatants, or all the combatants, tried to hide the outbreaks in their countries and cover it up, Spain was actually reporting it, since they weren't combatants. And so that's why people called it the Spanish flu, because the other countries were censoring the information about it. So, yeah, but there's a lot of history there to the Spanish flu epidemic that we can and should be learning from today.
Since you started down that road there, the historical road and the tip of the iceberg, you're reminding us that there are a lot of places we could look back to and see where we, not only were we not prepared prior, but because we have this history, you have argued that we clearly should have been far more prepared in terms of where we are now. So perhaps we can get into a little bit more historical trajectory here. And I know that you've talked a lot about the impact of neoliberalism on our institutions. Can you talk a little bit about missed historical opportunities where we could have sunk a lot more resources into protecting ourselves from real dangers instead of oft-contrived ones?
Well, that's where we get back into the manifesto that you and I started talking about. And if we look at the points of the manifesto, what we're trying to do here is help and encourage people to think in terms of the broad neoliberal onslaught against all the institutions that are so fundamental to survival on our planet. You know, Freud talks in 1929 in his great book, Civilization and Its Discontents, about the death instinct. And in many ways, as a planet, we seem to have the kind of death instinct that Freud was warning about then. And the forms that this takes in terms of the militarization of the planet, we even see as recently as February of this year, when the pandemic was already spreading, we see Trump's 2021 budget proposal, in which he proposes a $7 billion increase for spending on nuclear weapons. And he, at the same time, he proposes a $1.2 billion cut to the Centers for Disease Control. This is, as you know full well, this has been going on in this kind of flagrant way since the 1980s. It was under Reagan, even much more so than under Nixon or Ford, but it was under Reagan that the idea that government was the enemy, that government was not the solution, government was the problem, that idea became so popular and widespread. And we see over the next four decades a systematic undermining of government in every way they could possibly do it, in terms of the amount of money that goes to the states, in terms of the amount of money that the states give to the state universities, in terms of the percentage of the GDP that's going into health care, that's going into the vital services that people need to lead a good life. And, this has reached absurd proportions under Trump, but this idea of destroying the government is something that's very popular among Trump and his right-wing folks. The anti-tax activist Grover Norquist said, "I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub."
Yes.
And so what does that mean? That means cutting the services, giving a vast tax cut, $1 trillion tax cut to the very wealthiest in society, and then saying, well, we're running these deficits, so we've got to cut Social Security, we've got to cut health care. I mean, Trump has been trying to get rid of the Obamacare since he got to office. And just think of how much worse off we would be. Obamacare was certainly inadequate for the problems we faced, but compared to what Trump has in mind, it's a savior for a lot of people. But this is an opportunity now when it comes to health care, for example. The first point in the manifesto reads, "We demand strong universal health care systems and health care as a basic right for all humans." I mean, that's really obvious, right? We used to be able to say that there were two industrial countries in the world that didn't have a national health care program that covered all its citizens. It used to be the United States and South Africa. Once Mandela took power, then South Africa did develop a national health care program. But the United States still does not cover everybody. We should have had the Wagner Act passed in 1939 based on the idea that health care is a basic human right. Well, and then the other point that we always make is that the United States, we spend twice as much for health care as any other country, and the outcomes are much worse in all kinds of ways. So we're seeing the effects of that now. We've got a very, very unhealthy population, which is part of what makes this coronavirus so dangerous. these pre-existing conditions that make them very, very vulnerable to bad outcomes. We also have terrible nutrition problems in this country. The obesity problem is really out of control in the United States. People eating fast foods, junk foods, rather than healthy foods. Many parts of the country they can't even get. It's very difficult to get healthy foods. So what we tried to do in this manifesto is touch on a lot of these key points. The first one about healthcare is obvious because everybody sees that. But part of the problem we have is the Democratic Party is still so bankrupt and in some ways corrupt.
Hold that point right there, Peter Kuznick. I just want to remind listeners, if you're tuned to the Project Censored Show, I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We are speaking with the historian, Professor Peter Kuznick of American University, co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. On today's show, we're talking to Peter Kuznick about COVID-19 and the realities for our world. And we're also talking about a new manifesto. And after this musical break, we're going to continue our conversation with historian Peter Kuznick. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we welcome back Professor Peter Kuznick of American University. He's co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States, which is a fabulous text that's now in its second edition, 800 pages with new material added from the Obama years. And of course, this is also a 12-part series that you can watch the documentary. It's available on Netflix and other places online. But Peter Kuznick, before the break, we were talking about this transnational COVID-19 social solidarity manifesto. You're part of a working group, and you started talking about some of the demands, some of the things that are coming out of this session, this really important session during this global pandemic. And we were talking about the demand for strong universal healthcare systems and how the United States is basically the only industrial power to not offer healthcare to its citizens. I couldn't help but think about FDR's Four Freedoms speech. In future days, which we seek to make secure, we look forward to a world founded upon four essential human freedoms. The first is freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world. The second is freedom of every person to worship God in their own way everywhere in the world. The third is freedom from want everywhere in the world. And the fourth is freedom from fear anywhere in the world. And Roosevelt ends by saying that is no vision of a distant millennium. It is a definite basis for a kind of world attainable in our own time and generation. Well, here we are 80 years later, and we're still trying to achieve that.
Well, that's basically what our manifesto is talking about, kind of things that we're talking about. The second point calls for a global ceasefire and all conflicts, an end to war, that every nation move at least half its military spending to providing health care, housing, child care, nutrition, education, internet access, and other social needs. We talk about closing foreign military bases, stopping military exercises, abolishing nuclear weapons. The third point talks about an unsustainable capitalist economy and the need for a cooperatively based economy of care that protects biodiversity, natural resources. And we talk about ending sanctions. I mean, we go through the basic kinds of fundamental issues that we're all facing now, and we end by saying, in a world where the gap between the rich and the poor is obscene, with the richest 8 people having more wealth than the poorest 3.8 billion people, a fundamental redistribution of wealth and power globally and within nations is imperative. Every human being must have the opportunity to live a healthy, creative, and fulfilling life free of the ravages of poverty, exploitation, and domination. So in some ways, is this a utopian document? Yes. But it's the fruition, the realization of what progressives have been wanting for 200 years. And we should be demanding this. We were also talking earlier about that it's so disappointing that the Democratic Party is not able to provide any real leadership at this point. In my view, Joseph Biden is head and shoulders superior to Donald Trump, and I will support him every way I can in this election because Trump is so dangerous. But Biden is a very, very weak candidate in a lot of ways. The fact that one of his big issues was his opposition to Bernie Sanders' demand for Medicare for All. I mean, what would be more timely now than Medicare for All? What is more obviously needed in the United States than Medicare for All? I mean, that's, I mean, even people that we saw in the surveys, that the percentage of Americans who supported it jumped 9 points in the first week of the national lockdown in the United States to 55%. I haven't seen any recent surveys, but I'm sure it's up much higher than that. But Biden has not been providing any kind of leadership. He should really, like, you see Cuomo out there and Gavin Newsom and some others.
These are neoliberals. These people are far to the right of Franklin Roosevelt. And in a lot of ways, you know, the talk about Bernie Sanders being a socialist and this kind of thing, Bernie Sanders, to me at least, sounded more like FDR.
Yes. I mean, in fact, I was very critical of Sanders for unnecessarily alienating people by insisting that he was a socialist or a democratic socialist. When, according to my definition, he was not. He was a New Deal liberal. I would have been happy if he had been a socialist, but I'm certainly willing to settle for a New Deal liberal these days who could get us back to the values that FDR espoused, or even more so, of course, that Henry Wallace espoused and fought for. But Bernie Sanders, I think that there were a lot of ways, in many respects, he ran a very flawed campaign. But that was not the reason why he lost. It just gave his enemies more ammunition for going after him. But Biden is, as much as I want to say over and over again, that he's superior in every way to Donald Trump, his foreign policy over the years has been pretty disastrous. Like with Hillary, hard to find a war that he doesn't support, or military intervention that he doesn't support, or military spending bill that he doesn't endorse. In the same ways that I saw her as a deeply flawed candidate, her weaknesses...
Hillary Clinton's?
Hillary Clinton, in the same sense that Biden does. He's not going to be able to take advantage of Trump's glaring weaknesses because he's so deficient in the same ways. In the same sense that Hillary Clinton was not able to go after Trump's sexual assault of women because of her own husband's track record in that regard, Joseph Biden is also compromised in those ways and is not going to be in a strong position to go after Trump in that regard. When Biden criticizes Trump's foreign policy, Trump will point to the fact that Biden supported the invasion of Afghanistan, the invasion of Iraq, the Persian in Libya. And so I see Biden as a deeply flawed candidate. But we've just seen in the last days how dangerous Donald Trump is. I mean, his latest thing, that people should be injecting antiseptics of some sort into their bloodstream in order to kill the virus, Listerine and other things. This is madness. I think that really the 25th Amendment is really needed now more than ever. If we look at the things he's been raving about these last few days, he's gone off the deep end.
Right, and the corporate media shouldn't be covering this kind of, look, let's call it what it is. It's a pseudo event. It's exactly what Daniel Boorstin warned about in 1962's book, The Image, particularly citing the press conference and debates and these things as staged charades of sorts. With the Trump administration, this has all taken a new level. The shelter-in-place orders. Prior to that, Trump was rallying. He was speaking out around the country, whipping up a frenzy in his supporters. Now that can't be going on anymore, and by the way, he wasn't doing pressers, right? He wasn't doing a lot of press conferences. Now he's taking advantage of doing them every day to turn it into like a circus where he says outlandish things. And what I'm wondering is, why does the corporate media even bother showing up for this? Why don't they just look at experts? Why don't they talk to people where there are legitimate debates going on about what we should be doing about this? That's what the media should be doing. That's what journalists should be doing. But instead, they keep offering him a platform to say these incredibly absurd things. So I'd suggest that this is also a failed opportunity for the free press to reinvigorate itself. The last few shows we've done, we've talked about people getting bailouts and stimulus packages and these kind of things. Many millions of Americans haven't and won't. But this is a great time to be arguing for a stimulus for journalism, to get more people out there covering real investigative issues rather than the inane commentary that comes out of the president's mouth every chance he gets.
Well, that was very well said. I agree with you entirely. On the one hand, what he was saying wasn't so dangerous, then he'd be giving some comic relief. I mean, it's really like a clown, like a carnival barker up there, and it's entirely predictable that what's going to come out of his mouth, although every day he comes up with some new crazy thing in order to distract from the real issues, one of which is that his administration has set new benchmarks for complete and utter incompetence. It's not surprising. Again, this is part of what we've seen since the 1980s, where there's been this systematic erosion of trust in science and expertise. And you look at the people in the Trump administration, the cabinet secretaries, their goal is to destroy the departments that they're supposed to head. But in terms of expertise, the man who Trump put in charge of the coronavirus task force was Vice President Pence. There's probably not a less qualified person on the planet to be in charge of a coronavirus task force. This guy does not believe in science, nothing even rational about him. He dismissed climate change as a myth. He said the Earth is actually cooler today than it was about 50 years ago. He rejects evolutionary theory. He tells the congressional representatives, only the theory of intelligent design provides even a remote rational explanation for the known universe. He says that smoking doesn't kill. He says that condoms are a very, very poor protection against sexually transmitted disease. He says that the U.S. has the cleanest air and water in the world. And says the best solution for the state of Indiana's HIV outbreak last decade was to prey on it. So this is the man who gets put in charge of the coronavirus task force. Again, and this has been the case with the Trump base for the last few years, and that is what the Republican Party has become, an anti-science, anti-evidence, anti-rational, bizarre grouping. And we've had these know-nothings and ignorant people manifesting themselves, rising up at other times. And we've certainly had the kind of racism and bigotry that Trump has played upon throughout our history. But I think that Trump has now brought the assault on science and medicine and expertise to a new level. And we're seeing the deadly consequences of it. And this is not an abstraction anymore. This has become deadly. And the danger is it could be so much worse. Go back just to the 1918 epidemic. We figure that there were about 1.8 billion people in the world at that point. Of those, 500 million got the flu. In the United States alone, 675,000 people died. And most of those, again, to repeat myself, came in the second and third waves, not the first wave. So this is deadly serious stuff. And to have somebody who's that incompetent and that out of touch with reality going up there, as you say, with these daily distractions would be humorous if it was a different context. But now it's not humorous now. Now it's very, very serious. And people do the things that he says, although not that many. I mean, but you've got some who are elected officials, like the governor of Georgia, this fellow Brian Kemp. The levels of ignorance of these people is kind of shocking. It was in early April that Kemp says he just discovered that asymptomatic transmission is possible. People have been talking about that for 2 months, and the governor of Georgia, who thinks it's so necessary to get people back to the tattoo parlors, just found that out 2 months after the rest of us all knew that this was the case. One of the things that's become so obvious is that we were caught asleep, that we were just not prepared. Despite the fact, in the United States, take it back to Obama in 2015, Obama was very, very aware early on about the dangers. The National Security Council opened an office on pandemics in 2015. Before Trump took over, Lisa Monaco at HHS in January of 2017 organized what she called a nightmare scenario simulation, very similar to what we're facing now. Pandemic, travel bans, the stock market collapsing. The Trump people have known about these things. HHS in 2019 did a month-long simulation of how to deal with this. And yet, was the Trump administration in any way prepared? We didn't have ventilators. We didn't have masks. We didn't have PPE. We didn't have gowns. We just were totally unprepared. But we have to deal with this globally. We're seeing how it's affecting Spain and Italy and the United States, pretty advanced, relatively well-off countries. It's just beginning to hit the less developed part of the world where people were already barely living above subsistence levels, where the health care is much, much worse, where environmental degradation is even worse in many respects. So if it's going to happen when it gets to a country like Brazil, where you've got a thug, an ignorant thug like Bolsonaro running the government there. We've seen in places like Hungary the way this is being used for greater repression, but we're seeing a lot of that similar kind of thing happening in Brazil and Bolivia.
I just wanted to remind everybody you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We're speaking with historian Peter Kuznick. We're talking about the COVID-19 world, and we're talking about a new social solidarity manifesto that Peter Kuznick was part of. And after this brief musical break, we're going to continue our conversation with historian Peter Kuznick. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we are delighted to have historian Peter Kuznick from American University. He's co-author with Oliver Stone of the book Untold History of the United States. It's a New York Times bestseller, and it's a companion to the Showtime documentary series of the same name, which is available online and also on Netflix and other places. Peter Kuznick, before the break, you were talking about, you mentioned Know-Nothings a few minutes ago. And you were talking about Governor Kemp in Georgia. Kemp isn't alone, right? We saw this happening in Florida. We see this happening in other states. And it does seem to align with political parties and ideological perspectives rather than sound science or factual information. Could you talk a little more about that?
Yes, and this is not a spontaneous movement to demand opening up the economy. I mean, there are real economic issues. A lot of people are hurting in the United States now. It's making the inequality in this country even more glaring, and the problems with homelessness and lack of access to medical care and healthy food is all being even that much more obvious right now. But there are certain people who are trying to exploit it. These are the same people who started the Tea Party several years ago. What you've got is that these people are being egged on by these extreme right-wing groups and these gun nuts who form the core of Donald Trump's political base. And they go there with their Confederate flags, demanding that the economy is open before they're in any way prepared to do so. So we see it in states like Georgia and South Carolina and Florida and Texas. And these states are actually the least equipped to handle the results of what these governors are going to be unleashing. They've got the most vulnerable populations due to obesity, pre-existing health conditions, poverty, poor housing, shoddy education. worse than anywhere else in the country in many cases. And so to see them out there encouraging people to ignore social distancing, to not wear masks at a time when we're trying to mitigate and to control this outbreak is going to lead to, I'm afraid, terrible consequences in those very states. But then there's no way to contain it to those states, and then it's going to spread across the country, and we're going to see new waves of this, even in the places where we think it's starting to be somewhat contained. So I think it's very, very dangerous, but it's part of Trump's reelection strategy. Trump's whole claim to deserve being reelected was based upon the stock market and supposedly the best economy the U.S. or the world has ever seen, which, of course, is not true. But whatever basis he had for claiming to deserve reelection has now been eroded, and his numbers are dropping, and people are seeing him, or at least some people are seeing him, for the clown that he is. But only 12% of the American people, according to the latest polls, say that we need to speed up restarting the economy. So the people who support this movement, it's a very minority movement of extreme right-wingers, and 12% of the public supports that. Something like 86% either thinks, or 87% thinks, that we're doing it right now, or we should even slow down more than we have been. But the media, again, we were talking about the media giving so much play to Trump. Well, the media is also giving a lot of play to these small demonstrations. You know, you've got these people riding around in their cars, honking their horns and going around in circles, or actually out on the streets without any social distancing, without masks. These are very small minority demonstrations. They need to be talked about because they do represent a kind of proto-fascist potential in society. And that's one of the things that we're seeing in many parts of the world, is that there are leaders out there who are exploiting this situation to actually impose greater and greater repression. We're seeing, for example, in a place like India, where Muslims are being blamed for spreading coronavirus and being attacked by mobs. We've seen lynchings take place. We've seen leaders encourage this, fanning the flames of this kind of prejudice. And, you know, there's a long history of this in the United States, especially when it comes to disease. It was the Irish in the 1830s who were blamed for typhoid. Remember Typhoid Mary? It was the Jews at the end of the 19th century who were blamed for tuberculosis. In your neck of the woods, it was the Chinese in 1900 in San Francisco who were blamed for spreading bubonic plague. It was the Italians in 1916 who were blamed for the polio epidemic. And we saw it even more recently with the AIDS epidemic when the Haitians were being blamed. So this is something that we know when people are scared, it's very easy to fan the flames of that kind of hatred and bigotry. And that's Trump's calling card, is doing those kinds of things. So these are dangerous situations. And there are situations in which part of the cure or the control of this also requires technological tools that can be used for greater surveillance. When these crises emerge, as we saw after 9/11 with the Patriot Act, there are a lot of people who are eager to take away other civil liberties in order to impose much more societal control. And that potential exists very much again with this coronavirus outbreak.
Well, Peter Kuznick, the COVID-19, I referred to it as COVID-911, not for the emergency nature of it, but because for the exact historical analogy that you just brought up, this isn't to suggest in any way that COVID-19 is a hoax or isn't real. This is all very real. It's very problematic. It's dangerous, as you've mentioned a number of times, but there's a whole raft of other very dangerous long-term things that are being floated out right now, including digital surveillance. You mentioned crackdown on liberties. So let's get back to that really quickly, because these protests, these not-so-spontaneous protests, rather AstroTurf, Koch brother kind of protests that we see sprouting up, California just banned protests at the state capitol. On one level, that's very disconcerting. on another, given the situation, okay, we're understanding that there's some cover for it. We have to be careful how long that cover lasts. But I wanted to get to what's underneath this. The protests are allegedly designed to, quote, reopen the economy. But part of the manifesto that we were talking about earlier, the third thing says, we demand that our unsustainable capitalist economy based on the fantasy of endless growth be replaced with a cooperatively based economy of care, where human life, biodiversity, our natural resources are conserved, and a universal basic income is guaranteed so that governments can work together to combat the existential threat of climate change. Now, let's get to that. There would be, if it weren't for the situation we're in, living in a neoliberal economic train wreck, even the World Bank and the IMF have said that neoliberalism and austerity have been colossal failures societally. If we actually had universal health care, universal basic income, then there wouldn't be such a rush, would there, Peter?
No, I mean, those seem like pretty radical ideas, but universal health care is something that the rest of the world, much of the world, does have already and can afford and has much better health outcomes than the United States. And the question of a guaranteed annual income, as you know, it was Richard Nixon who floated that idea a long time ago. This is not nearly as radical an idea, and we're seeing it now. What we really need is to think what it means that the richest 8 people in the world have more wealth than the poorest 3.8 billion people. What it means that the 6 Walmart heirs, brothers, have got more wealth than the bottom 30% of the American people. That the 3 richest Americans, Bezos and company, have more wealth than the bottom half of the American population. I mean, that's not sustainable. Not only is it immoral, it's irrational. We need to figure out what kind of global economy we want to have going forward. We're going to need to be investing a much greater percentage of global production in healthcare, because these kind of pandemics are just going to keep happening. We're a very globalized society now, and that can be a very good thing. But we've got leaders who've got the old mindset who are calling the shots still. And so instead of having leaders who say, what does the human population need? What does the planet need? What does the globe need? You got Trump saying, make America great again, and Putin wanting to make Russia great again, and Xi wanting to make China great again, and Modi wanting to make India great again. You just go around the world. And that kind of thinking right now is clearly not what we need. For example, there are leaders in the United States who have wanted to exploit this in order to go after China. China's track record was not great in the beginning. Okay, we all know that. But when Trump crosses out the lines written for him by his speechwriters, and instead of calling it the coronavirus, refers to it as the Chinese virus, or Pompeo referring it as the Wuhan virus, or Bannon calling it the PRC virus, blaming on the Communist Party in China, and then doing what they can to, again, fan the flames of hatred and ignorance and seeing this as a way to gain an upper hand on China rather than to talk about and think about how we must begin to cooperate globally with Russia and China and other countries. It was January 2018 that Secretary of Defense Mattis announced that threat to American national security is no longer international terrorism, it's now Russia and China. And it was also January of 2018 that the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists moved the hands of the doomsday clock to 2 minutes before midnight. However, in 2019, the Bulletin moved the hands of the doomsday clock to 100 seconds before midnight, which is the closest it's ever been. The tensions and the threats between the U.S. and Russia and the U.S. and China are very, very real. And what we've also seen recently is Trump, again, part of his plan of distraction, to ramp up the tensions between the U.S. and Iran, to give orders to shoot those Iranian boats if they get near American ships in the Gulf. In many ways, Trump would be very happy to see fighting between the U.S. and Iran, on the assumption that people will rally around the presidency. in a crisis situation like that. We almost went to war pretty recently after the shooting of Soleimani, and there's no reason to think that Trump would not be ruthless enough to provoke a war at a time like this.
We're speaking with historian Peter Kuznick, co-author of The Untold History of the United States with Oliver Stone. After this brief musical break, we are going to conclude our conversation. We're talking about the COVID-19 world, and we're also talking about a new working group that has a transnational COVID-19 social solidarity manifesto. We'll continue that conversation after this musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we've had the honor of welcoming back historian Peter Kuznick at American University. He is, of course, co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States bestseller. Also, it's a companion to the Showtime documentary series, which is available online now and streaming, and I believe at Netflix. Peter Kuznick, you're also part of a new working group working on a solidarity manifesto under the guise of the COVID-19, the coronavirus pandemic. We've actually been addressing a lot of the 9 points here that are going to be published soon. And before the break, you were talking about foreign policy implications, of course, the possibility of Trump getting us into maybe even more dangerous situations with warfare. So part of this manifesto calls for cessation of war, cessation of violence, withdrawing military bases, calls for universal basic income. Joseph Stiglitz, the economist, recently talked about how the U.S. coronavirus response was like a third world country. And of course, a lot of that comes from the neoliberal and austerity programs, and you mentioned some historically. This manifesto talks about the demanding full protection of all people, especially most vulnerable, including women, victims of intimate partner violence, child abuse, elderly, impoverished. I mean, again, the coronavirus, the COVID-19 crisis we face is laying bare the failures of our system. Would you say that that's what's at the root that's driving this manifesto, Peter Kuznick?
In some ways, yes. And we're trying to get people to think not only about the immediate obvious problems, but about the deeper causes. Because hopefully at some point the coronavirus will get a vaccine. Hopefully at some point, the most optimistic assessments are maybe within a year. But the problems are going to be with us, the global problems that we face. The immediate ones are not only the danger of such pandemics, but the nuclear threat continues, and climate change continues. Dealing with those kinds of things in the way that we're suggesting would allow, again, a changing of our priorities and our spending and our investments and our commitment to human beings. On the nuclear front, for example, the entire nuclear architecture has been dismantled, except for one thing, really. We've destroyed the ABM Treaty 18 years ago. Trump has wrecked the INF Treaty, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal, which was working fabulously. The only thing still standing is the New START Treaty, which limits the number of deployed strategic nuclear weapons and delivery systems. But that comes to an end in February 2021. Putin has urged Trump to renew it for another 5 years. Trump has said he doesn't like it, it's not a good treaty, and he doesn't want to. That would be disastrous. We could get back into an old-fashioned nuclear arms race. Trump says, I don't fear an arms race, I welcome one. Remember, back in the 1980s, we had close to 70,000 nuclear weapons around the world, the equivalent of 1.47 million Hiroshima bombs. What do we need 1.47 billion Hiroshima bombs for? The insanity of that, you can't just blame it on Trump. It was Obama who really began the 30-year trillion-plus dollar modernization program of all nuclear weapons, making them more efficient, more deadly. And now we know it's not $1 trillion, it's closer to $1.7 trillion. But it's just as insane whether Obama was proposing this or Trump is carrying this out now. And the more we know also about the effects of the use of nuclear weapons, it's a little bit off our topic today, but it's so important that I just want to mention that the latest studies about nuclear winter show that what Sagan and others were warning about in the 1980s was actually an underestimate of how dangerous these were, that the threshold was actually lower, that a limited nuclear war between India and Pakistan, which 100 Hiroshima-sized nuclear weapons were used, would send, the cities would burn, 5 million tons of soot and smoke would go up into the stratosphere, circle the globe within 2 weeks, block the sun's rays, temperatures on the earth would plummet to freezing, a big percentage of global agriculture would be wiped out, and just that limited nuclear war could lead to up to 2 billion deaths. And the reality is that we don't have 100 nuclear weapons. We've got 14,000 nuclear weapons, and they're not Hiroshima size. They're between 7 and 70 times as powerful as the Hiroshima bomb. This is the insanity that we're dealing with, or the insanity surrounding global warming. Trump and the people in his party are not only denying this, they're actually doing away with the regulations that are trying to limit the effects of global warming. So we're up against the lunatics running the asylum right now, and we're running out of time to actually being able to reverse these things. One of the things I like to point to when it comes to global warming was a terrific statement by the Pope, by Pope Francis. But Pope Francis also gave a message recently in relation to the coronavirus. I think it was on Easter Sunday. And among the things he said is that international sanctions should be relaxed, and that the debt burden should be wiped off the balance sheets of the poorest nations. He said that we need an immediate global ceasefire. That's not a time to continue to manufacture and deal in arms, spend vast amounts of money that ought to be used to care for others and save lives. He talked about the bloodshed in Syria, Yemen, Iraq, and Lebanon, and between the Israelis and Palestinians, and Ukraine. And I mean, he went on and on talking about a lot of the basic kinds of things that we're talking about in the manifesto. What we need is a different definition of global priorities, not in the interest of warfare, the interest of geopolitical gain, not in the interest of territorial gain, but in the interest of human needs on a global scale.
Just get a little background on the working committee here on the Transnational COVID-19 Social Solidarity Manifesto that's going to be coming out soon. Could you tell us how this group got together? Who are the folks that you're working with?
We've been meeting by Zoom for over a month now. It was actually initiated by my close friend and colleague, David Vine. David teaches with me at American University. He's the Chalmers Johnson of the next generation. His book, Base Nation, is the outstanding leading study about U.S. bases around the world. It was Chalmers Johnson who warned that the United States had become an empire of bases and exposed the fact and that aspect of American militarism. Well, David Vine has taken it even further, and people should really read Base Nation to get a better understanding. So David initiated this and has been working with the anti-base movement all over the planet. So many of the people who are involved are anti-base activists, but I would say that most of the people who have been involved in the first five or so phone calls, Zoom meetings, have been scholars and activists, the same kind of thing that we've seen involved in every important social movement. We're finalizing the manifesto. What we want to do now is come up next with the name for the manifesto or the group. Then we're going to start to get signatures, and we're going to put it up through social media and through various other places online. and we want to use this to frame the discussion. We need to be organizing, educating, and raising the issues that people can understand much more now than they could before. I think this crisis is bringing home the reality in ways that weren't as obvious to people before. And it's also, you can say in some limited sense, it's having some positive effect. For example, some of the war games, the military exercises had to be canceled. On March 11th, Norway canceled Cold Response, a big NATO operation with 15,000 troops, NATO war games. 2 days later, they canceled Defender Europe 20, another big NATO war game, and when the Germans pulled out of that. So I think it's becoming clearer and clearer that we should not be wasting precious human resources on building up our militaries and looking for ways to gain advantage over each other. But what's becoming clear is that we need to be working together globally. So I participated this morning in an international forum based in Germany with a lot of Russian participants about the end of World War II in Europe, the meeting at the Elbe River between the American and the Russian troops. And I gave a talk at that today. And the message that we all shared was with some American military people and Russian military people and scholars, was that was an example of the Americans and the Russians, Americans and Soviets working together in order to defeat fascism in 1945. Well, now it's 75 years later. And think of what we've wasted throughout the Cold War. Think of human resources that have been squandered on building up the means of killing rather than creating the kind of planet that we always be much, much happier to have now.
Well, Peter Kuznick, that certainly is a positive way to look at what's happening now and what we could be working toward in the future. So Peter Kuznick, historian, American University, co-author of The Untold History of the United States with Oliver Stone, companion to the Showtime documentary series that streams also online, Netflix, and other places. Peter Kuznick, it's always a delight to have you on the program. You always have a wealth of perspectives and knowledge to share that people really need to hear and consider. And so thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule. We'll have you on again, and we hope to hear what happens with the manifesto, and we'll do a follow-up. So thanks again for coming on.
Thank you.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear this.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by myself along with Peter Phillips. I'm the executive producer, Mickey Huff, of this program, also the host. Our co-host is Chase Palmieri. Anthony Fest, our senior producer. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. Thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, far for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, hypnotized by the master thief. Combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out, the reach on potential.